What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Phyllis Goldstein, the author of A Convenient Hatred, The History of Antisemitism. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach. It's the holiday of Shavuot today, the festival that commemorates our ancestors receiving the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, and the most important of all the least observed Jewish holidays on our very complicated calendar. Shavuot has never enjoyed the popularity of its cousin festival, Passover, but this shouldn't really surprise us now, should it? Somehow, freedom, which is celebrated on Pesach, is a much easier message to sell than covenant, which is explored on Shavuot, and liberty outpolls responsibility in every vote. But Shavuot has important lessons to teach and lovely rituals to celebrate, some of which are surprising and very beautiful. In biblical times, Shavuot was one of the three most important Jewish festivals, ranking with Passover in the spring and Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles in the autumn, as one of the pilgrimage festivals, a time when Jews literally walked to Jerusalem to celebrate the holiday at the Great Temple. Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, is called Pentecost by Christians, as it marks the conclusion of 7 weeks of counting from the second night of Passover all the way through the 50th day. Get it? Penta, meaning five? 50th day. That's the Feast of Weeks, Shavuot. According to the book of Exodus, our ancestors tramped across the Sinai from the Sea of Reeds, newly liberated slaves on the first stage of their journey to the Promised Land. 7 weeks after leaving Egypt, they camped at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they were blessed with the most direct communication God ever gifted to humanity. There, amidst thunder and lightning, with the earth quaking and the sound of the shofar ringing out, the Aseret HaDibrot were proclaimed, the 10 statements that remain at the heart of all Western religion. One God, keep the Sabbath, honor your father and mother, no murder, theft, adultery, perjury, each of those famous commandments. It was a tremendously powerful moment. By tradition, as God proclaimed these 10 commandments, each person, man, woman, and child, stood and listened in awed, motionless silence. Also by tradition, even the animals present, cattle, sheep, goats, horses, and so on, stood and silently observed, hearing God's direct voice. The power and majesty of the moment were complete. Never before had God been revealed to this degree. Never again would God speak to an entire nation arrayed before God, directly experiencing the divine presence. Of course, it's not just the drama of the scene that's so striking in the text of the Torah. It's also the content of the revelation. For the Ten Commandments form the basis of Western ethics for the next 3,000 years. They are still at the center of most contemporary discussions of how we know what is right or wrong. It is on Shavuot, at the foot of that desert mountain in Sinai, that our central mission in the world was given. It is there that the various tribes of Israel truly became a nation. It was at Sinai that our fractious ancestors were transformed into the Jewish people. To celebrate that great early morning revelation and the night of preparation that preceded it, an all-night study session called the Tikkun Leil Shavuot was established by the mystic Kabbalists in the 1500s in Sfat in the north of Israel. We join in that wonderful practice today, staying up all night, last night, in fact, which makes me more than a bit sleepy today. We rejoice in the great texts and teachings of our people throughout history. Any Jewish subject is fair game on this night of dedication to Torah, exploring all the great subjects and books of Judaism. You know, as this silly, newish Chabad song would have it, from a woman known as Rebbetzin Tapp, who is actually a chiropractor in Ramat Beit Shemesh in Israel, by the way, she creates fairly silly but clever Jewish songs. This one is about Shavuot, and it's entitled Stay Up All Night.
The sixth of Sivan, it's the day that we receive on.
Anything you want to learn, it's alright.
Put some water in the urn.
Stay up all night.
Put on your fedora. Time for Kabbalah Satorah. Anything you want to wear, it's alright.
Just keep those thumbs in the air.
Stay up all night.
Chomesh Chazara,
Mishnah Chazara,
Gemara Chazara,
yeah!
Eat a melon or a mango when you do the Torah tango.
Priya Adama or eight, that's right.
Got to make it tonight.
Stay up all night.
Say some prakim of Tehillim. Keep your coffee cup from spilling.
If you're starting to sway, it's all right.
Try our cheesecake buffet.
Stay up all night.
Navi Chazara,
Musar Chazara,
Halacha Chazara, yeah!
So wake up your chevrusas. This is no time for excuses.
Anything to help you focus, it's alright.
Cause there's really no machlokis.
Stay up all night.
Hold on to your stander. We can't possibly surrender.
Cause you know it is Shavuos, that's right.
And the only thing to do is
stay up all night.
Cause you know it is Shavuos, that's right.
And the only thing to do is
stay up all night.
Gonna stay up all.
Gonna stay up all.
We're gonna stay up all night.
That was some of the Rebbetzin Tapp's silly Stay Up All Night. In addition to the revelation at Sinai, there are several other important elements to Shavuot, called Shavuos in Yiddish and Ashkenazic Hebrew, by the way, and these are important and beautiful too. As in each of the three greatest biblical festivals, Shavuot has an important agricultural theme. It was the festival of first fruits, the Chag HaBikurim, when our ancestors brought an offering to the temple in Jerusalem of the very first harvest of their fields and crops. Barley is the first grain crop to ripen in Israel, and Chag HaBikurim included carrying baskets of barley and fresh figs, also early to ripen, and dried fruits and nuts to the holy city. The lovely biblical Book of Ruth is chanted on Shavuot, partly because it takes place in Israel, in Bethlehem to be precise, at the time of the barley harvest. In pre-state Israel, the Yishuv that preceded the establishment of the modern nation in 1948, the Zionist pioneers, the Chalutzim, celebrated the bounty of the newly fertile land of Eretz Yisrael on Shavuot, and it became an important kibbutz holiday. This has a food impact on Shavuot. It is a tradition to eat all kinds of fresh fruit on Shavuot. More about food in a moment. Of course, we're Jewish. In addition to the Torah and the first fruits aspect of Shavuot, there is also a tradition among Sephardic communities that Shavuot is a kind of wedding ceremony, a celebration of the marriage of the Jewish people to God in the covenantal relationship we call Torah. A special ketubah, the wedding contract used in Jewish nuptials, is often read aloud on Shavuot Eve, marking this symbolic union. It's notable that in traditional Judaism, no weddings are permitted during the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuot, save on the one day of Lag BaOmer. Shavuot Shavuos marks the beginning of the return of wedding celebrations with this lovely Sephardic tradition. And if that were not enough to celebrate on one or two festival days, the Reform Movement determined that its largest communal coming-of-age ceremony, Confirmation, would take place on or around Shavuot. Confirmation celebrates the completion of a more intellectually in-depth learning process than Bar Bat Mitzvah, and it marks the maturation of a young person's concepts of God and Jewish identity at around the age of 16. It used to be of supreme importance to Reform Jews, and it still has great resonance for young Jewish Reform adults today. And, of course, there is the important and interesting tradition that on Shavuot we do not eat meat. Instead, We celebrate by eating all kinds of delicious dairy products, milk, cheese, blintzes, and especially cheesecake, perhaps the greatest Jewish dessert of all. The reason for this dairy-centered vegetarianism is unclear. There are many different justifications given in the Talmud, Midrash, and the Codes. One says that it's because the Torah is like milk and honey. For just as milk has the capacity to fully nourish a baby, so Torah has the ability to spiritually nourish us completely. Another tradition says that at the foot of Mount Sinai, even the animals stopped and heard the voice and word of God. They, too, received a form of revelation, and out of respect, we must not kill any of them for our own use on this festival of Shavuot. That has led to many wonderful cheesecake-related traditions. Look, I'm not talking about revealing poses or photographs, but the real, absolutely delicious pastry that comes in so many forms and styles. There's actually a restaurant called the Cheesecake Factory that doesn't even know how to make a proper New York cheesecake, although their stuff is actually delicious. I do wonder just a bit why people, that is the Jewish people, so much inclined towards lactose intolerance have chosen to make cheesecake the formative food of a major festival, but what the heck. Eat cheesecake today on Shavuot, on Shavuos, and recover tomorrow. Carpe dere diem, as it were. Eat now, and tomorrow we diet. And one final element of Shavuot, it is the festival of conversion in Judaism, both because we all became Jews at Mount Sinai, converted to the covenant of the Ten Commandments, but also because we chant the Book of Ruth, which includes the most beautiful conversion statement in all of Jewish tradition. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And so to play us in, here's a famous classic Shavuot song that captures the power and presence of this great moment in human history. Actually, it turns out there aren't any famous classic Shavuot songs. While there are many, many great Passover songs, and possibly even more fine and fun Hanukkah songs, and even a couple of really good Sukkot songs, there just aren't any classic Shavuot songs, nor are there even any pretty well-known Shavuot songs. Yeah, there's lots of Torah songs, but most of them were actually written for Simchat Torah, or just as generic songs about the Torah. There aren't any Shavuot songs. Maybe somebody will write one that will bring more Jews to realize what a truly lovely holiday we have here, just at the cusp of summer. The closest we really get are Israeli songs about the beautiful fields of Israel, or nice love songs. Not bad. I guess they'll have to do. And so, to finally play us in today, here's a classic Sephardic song about love and marriage and elopement, by the way, called Scalarica del Oro, the Little Ladder of Gold, as sung by the sons of Sfarad.
Scalarica del Oro. De oro y de marfil, para que suba la novia a dar kidushin. Venimos a ver, venimos a ver. Y gocen, ni logren, ni tengan mucho bien. Venimos a ver, venimos a ver. Y gocen, ni logren, ni tengan mucho bien.
Bueno. That was the Sons of Sfarad, Alberto Mizrahi, Gerard Ettery, and Aaron Bensoussan singing Scalarica del Oro, kind of about Shavuot today, if you just squint a little bit and pretend. Moving on, our guest this morning has written the most comprehensive and readable exploration of the greatest hatred in human history. Find out what it is and how she came to write it when we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the Family Size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Phyllis Goldstein. She's the author of A Convenient Hatred, The History of Anti-Semitism, a very interesting new book that sort of surveys the whole history of anti-Semitism, not a small or minor subject. Introduction actually is by Sir Harold Evans, distinguished author and academic. And Phyllis has done, I think, something unique to comprehensively cover this entire subject, working with a very interesting organization, and I'll ask her to tell you about it. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good morning.
So, Facing History in Ourselves, an unusual organization. I really had never heard of it until I received this in the mail, but it's quite an organization. Tell us a little bit about what you guys do.
We're a nonprofit educational organization that links history to the moral questions of our time. We work with teachers, we work with students, not only in the United States, but in countries around the world. Our primary case study focuses on the events that led to the Holocaust.
Of course. This book, A Convenient Hatred, just published, was sponsored by a donor to try to survey the whole history of anti-Semitism. There are interesting books on anti-Semitism, but I'm not aware of something quite like this. Can you talk about creating this?
Yeah, it grew out of our work. What we've been finding for some time now is that no matter how carefully we teach this history, our teachers and their students come to it without knowing very much about anti-Semitism, which is, as you know, central to the story that we're telling. And as we try to find ways to give them a better grasp of this history, we found that it was not only our teachers and our students who were having trouble with this history, but we were finding that it was a larger, more general problem that very few people, Jews or non-Jews, seem to know much about the history of anti-Semitism. And since we're based on a belief that if you don't know where you've been, you have no idea where you're headed, the past is really critical to understanding anti-Semitism in the present. And so the idea for this book grew out of that particular need.
I think one of the first guests on Too Jewish 10 years ago was Professor Leonard Dinnerstein, who wrote Anti-Semitism in America. It's a great book. He's a great guy. And we were discussing, at that time, he was seeing a steady recession in anti-Semitism in America. This was kind of before 9/11. Well, maybe it was just after 9/11, but I don't think people quite had the sense that the increased level of anti-Semitism in the world. Is anti-Semitism increasing or decreasing at this point, do you think?
It seems to be increasing. In the United States, not as much as in countries around the world. In Europe, it's a serious problem, and the European Union has recognized it. It's not a Middle Eastern problem. It seems to be the traditional anti-Semitism that is on the rise in too many places, including some here, but certainly not to the degree that we're seeing in Europe and other parts of the world.
We will talk much more a little later this morning on Too Jewish with Phyllis Goldstein. Her book is A Convenient Hatred, The History of Anti-Semitism, when we come back.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows streaming through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts. You know, we Jews are really funny. Last week, Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, established a national unity government that demonstrates the greatest degree of political solidarity in all of Israel's 64-year history. And he made the cover of Time magazine the same week. Israel's economy is in fine shape, terrorism has declined to nearly nothing, and tourism is up hugely. Syria, Israel's most powerful nearby enemy, is engaged in a brutal civil war that makes it impossible for it to attack Israel even by proxy right now. And Iran, Israel's most dangerous foe if it were to finish developing nuclear weapons, is the subject of intense international pressure that has devastated its economy and caused hyperinflation in Iran. Frankly, things are going pretty darn well for Israel, and I'll tell you more about that when I'm there next week. So naturally, all the Jewish commentators are writing that Netanyahu's ascent now makes it likely that Israel will collapse, democracy will die, and this makes everything terribly dangerous and worse for the Jewish people. You know, I've tried very hard, but I just don't see it that way. I know that congenitally we Jews must see a dark cloud surrounding every silver lining, but I just can't figure out why this would truly be terrible for Israel. Yes, it presents opportunities Israel might not capitalize upon. Well, heck, you can say that about all of us. Gee whiz, folks, lighten up. Things are pretty darn good right now in Eretz Yisrael, and we should celebrate that, rather than imagine that there must be another shoe just about to drop. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about some new ideas about how to do Israel education in the United States. Instead of presenting Israel as perfect all the time, instead presenting some of the complications, the complexities. We love Israel. We love Israel, including all of its complex relationships and some of the challenges it faces. That raises an interesting set of questions. You know, we were remember having a long discussion with a colleague who later became a close friend, although we weren't friends and I didn't like him initially, because I said, you know, Jews are the same all over the world. And he said, American Jewish teenagers and Israeli teenagers have almost nothing in common. And I said, oh, that's wrong. And then, you know, he's actually right. But I didn't want to talk about it that way because I thought it presented the wrong kind of image. How do those of us who are active in promoting Israel, in Jewish education, in synagogues, and all kinds of other contexts, how do those of us deal with those complications?
You know, I think that probably the point in life when you feel the differences and the similarities more than all is when you go to a lunch meal in a joint camp of Israeli teenagers and American Jews teenagers. And after the meal, the rabbi, usually it's a Reform rabbi,
of course,
hits the table and say, okay, friends, the birkat. Now, the American kids know exactly what he means. The Israeli kids look at one another. They don't understand what does this crazy
birkat
man talks
what?
About.
Yeah.
And then the American kids are starting to say the birkat hamazon. The Israeli kids look at each other, wandering around, you know, what are they doing? Those crazy Americans, what are they doing? And then the Americans finish to say the Birkat HaMazon. Now you have 300 American teenagers that just said the Birkat HaMazon, but know nothing about what they said.
Correct.
They just know how to pronounce it. And you have another 300 kids, Israeli kids in the room, that don't know the Birkat HaMazon, but understood every word that was said in the Birkat. And I think that this, in a sense, brings the similarities and the differences. Because the Americans, Judaism focuses a lot on faith and on those symbolic acts, in a sense. While the Israelis tend to leave, in a sense, maybe the meaning, they understand the language, they have this advantage, and the element of faith is not as strong in the Israeli culture. And I think that when we talked last week about complexities, that's another element, because unfortunately, many American educators, Jewish educators, when they talk about Israel, they focus only about the Israeli-Arab conflict, as if the Israeli-Arab conflict or the Palestinian issue is what defines our relationship with Israel. And that shouldn't be the case. Our relationship with Israel is the relationship within the Jewish people. Today, over 50% of the Jewish people live in Israel. Israel is the land where we look to when we're praying, any Jewish pray. When we break the glass in the marriage ceremony, it's in memory of the temple in Jerusalem. All of our history is connected to Jerusalem and to Israel. So that's something that we're kind of missing in our Israel education, Jewish education. And you know, just a while back, we had here in Tucson the Israel Festival. The Israel Festival was the biggest and greatest get-together of the Tucson Jewish community. In a sense, that demonstrates how Israel is central to our community. That was, I think, the only event in the year where you can see all the rabbis from Tucson, all the congregations, all the Jewish organizations in one room, and thousands of Jewish people celebrating together. So that has a meaning, and we should, in a sense, use this meaning.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert in the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started exploring the recent French election. You gave us a great primer on French politics. The socialists are just barely left of center, and there's kind of a right-wing coalition that's not terribly right, and then there's a much further right-wing coalition, well, right-wing party. Let's talk a little bit about what this particular election means and how, of course, as we always want to know, how it affects the Jews.
All right, so there's obviously at least two parts to that question, and I'm not sure how far we'll get this time around, but let's look at the recent history of French socialists when they were in power and their relationship to the Jewish community. I think it's instructive because the last time the socialists were overwhelmingly in power was under François Mitterrand. And Mitterrand had a record in the war that some people questioned. Some people thought he might have been a slight collaborationist or not strongly enough defending the Jews, whatever. But the fact is that in the war, no major French politician took a strong stand in defense of French Jews. So I don't think Mitterrand was better or worse than anybody else. I think that since then, the way the Socialist Party has evolved, and we're talking about more than 60 years after all, it has evolved as a party of tolerance, more egalitarianism for women, minorities, whatever. And oddly, in France, Jews are barely considered a minority. Minorities are more visible than Jews. They're French Africans or people from the Caribbean, or they're Muslims or people who wear obviously different clothes, or they're women. And the French socialists have been very good for all these groups. And the presumption, therefore, is they haven't been so good for Jews, or that they haven't been so good for Israel. And there's even a presumption among American French watchers, like there is among some American watchers of American politics, that somehow the right-wing parties are more pro-Israel than the left-wing parties. Now, Sarkozy, being part Jewish himself, being very eager to curry the favor of the U.S. government, may have been overtly more pro-Israel than preceding French governments. Not clear that he was overtly more pro-Jewish, because everybody in France has to court the Islamic vote. And if current demographic trends continue, at some point France may become a predominantly Muslim country. When that will be, hard to say, but there are a lot of French people who are already preoccupied with this vision. The fact is that under Mitterrand, the kitchen cabinet included a large number of Jews of either Eastern European origin or North African origin. And if you looked at sort of the 8 or 10 key advisors to the president, 5 or 6 of them were Jewish. And it was amazing to me how easy it was for me to talk with these guys, whether they were originally from Algiers or Cairo or Strasbourg or Poland. They were people who were familiar. They were in Mamalosh and Unzera, you know? I don't know how to translate that for your readers, your Eden. Listeners, sorry.
They were fellow Jews.
Right. And so, actually, the Mitterrand administration was very good for French Jews and not so bad for Israel, as people remember. I guess we'll talk next week about this particular election and what the future holds in store.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Levy was running behind with his daily schedule. He had to skip lunch. His last visit of the day was to see the elderly Mrs. Gold. When he arrived at the nursing home, the attendant said, "Rabbi, Mrs. Gold has been waiting to see you all day. She was afraid you forgot her." The rabbi apologized, went straight to Mrs. Gold's room, sat down in a chair next to her bed, said a few words of encouragement, and she began to talk. While he was listening, he noticed a small bowl of peanuts next to her, so he took a few of them. Mrs. Gold smiled and continued talking at length. A few minutes later, Rabbi Levy interrupted her and said, "Oh, Mrs. Gold, I'm sorry. I was so hungry. I've eaten almost all of your peanuts." Mrs. Gold smiled and said, "Oi, don't worry about it, Rabbi. I can't eat the peanuts because of my teeth. I just licked the chocolate from them." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and I'd skip the peanuts. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the book of Numbers, Naso, which includes a remarkable, beautiful blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests were commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing had exceptional importance. As the Torah quotes God saying, "With this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, Samu et Shemi." That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers us God's protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, the highest class of priests, those entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use this blessing at every single joyous life cycle event. It remains powerful. The text is, "May God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace." In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of this portion see the first blessing as a request for physical safety and health, the second asking for material needs to be satisfied, and the third seeking spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives become a challenge. But with all three, we are assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, these three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives and a gift from God. May you be blessed with each of these, with all of these, this week and always. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Phyllis Goldstein, will explain the origins and history of anti-Semitism and why it continues to exist even when there are no Jews to attack, when we return on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Proving that anti-Semitism is far from dead in today's Europe, vandals defiled a monument in Budapest to Raoul Wallenberg by hanging bloody pig's feet on a statue of the Swedish diplomat who saved thousands of Hungarian Jews' lives during the Holocaust. A group of tourists visiting the site found the defacement. Pictures show four or five severed pig's feet strung on a rope hanging on the statue, one of them positioned by Wallenberg's head. Budapest authorities promised immediate action on the case. This year, the centenary of Wallenberg's birth is being marked in Hungary as Raoul Wallenberg Year, while a neutral Swedish diplomat in Budapest after the German occupation of 1944, Wallenberg issued Swedish travel documents known as Wallenberg passports to at least 20,000 Jews and also set up more than 30 safe houses for Jews. He disappeared while being escorted out of Hungary towards the Soviet Union in January of 1945. Soviet authorities later admitted he died in prison there. A special prosecutor in Istanbul, Turkey, has prepared indictments against the four top Israeli commanders who led the 2010 raid on the Gaza-bound Mavi Marmara ship. The 144-page indictment seeks 10 aggravated life jail sentences for each commander, including former IDF Chief of Staff General Gabi Ashkenazi. The other Israeli commanders to be indicted reportedly are Israeli Navy Commander Vice Admiral Eliezer Marom, Israel's Military Intelligence Chief Major General Amos Yadlin, and Air Force's Intelligence Head Brigadier General Avishai Levy. The indictment mentions 10 slain Turks. Actually, 9 Turkish nationals, including a Turkish-American man, were killed during the raid. A 10th remains in a vegetative state. The indictment reportedly refers to 490 victims and complainants, including 189 people who were injured in the attacks, reportedly. The indictment has been submitted to Istanbul Chief Public Prosecutor Turan Kolakadi, who is expected to approve the request to submit it to the court. Israeli naval commandos on May 31, 2010, about 2 years ago, boarded the Mavi Marmara, which claimed to be carrying humanitarian aid, although it had lots of other stuff, after warning it not to sail into waters near Gaza. The Turkish nationals were killed in the ensuing clashes. Israel's government-appointed Turkle Commission found in its investigation the government and the military behaved appropriately and that Israel's naval blockade of Gaza was legal. The UN's Palmer Committee also found the blockade to be legal, but said Israel may have used excessive force while boarding the vessel. Turkey's inquiry deemed the Gaza blockade and the Israeli raid to have been illegal. Ankara has called on Israel for an official apology and compensation for the raid and for the lifting of the naval blockade of Gaza. The two countries have broken off diplomatic relations and military agreements since the incident. In Flushing, New York, a sellout crowd filled Citi Field. It wore, however, black and white, not the New York Mets, blue and orange like usual. Instead of jeering the Philadelphia Phillies or Atlanta Braves, they faced a foe that was far more formidable, the World Wide Web. The Internet, even with a filter, is a minefield of immorality, said Rabbi Ephraim Wachsman, a Haredi and ultra-Orthodox lecturer. This issue is the test of the generation. Your strength at this gathering will determine what Judaism will look like a few years from now. The rally was to caution Haredi Orthodox Jews about the dangers of the Internet. It drew a crowd of more than 40,000 men to the stadium, most of them wearing, of course, black hats. The group that organized the rally, Ichud HaKehilas LeTohar HaMachaneh, the Union of Communities for Purity of the Camp, barred women from attending in accordance with a Haredi practice of separating sexes. In Yiddish and English speeches, rabbis from Haredi communities in the U.S., Canada, and Israel decried the access that the Internet gives Haredim to the world outside their community. Speakers called the Internet impure, a threat to modesty, and compared it to chametz on Pesach. To a man, each of the rabbis, of course there were no women rabbis, each of the rabbis who spoke said the Jewish law forbids Jews from browsing the Internet without a filter that blocks inappropriate sites. The speeches in Yiddish were broadcast with English subtitles on the stadium's Jumbotron. Rabbi Yechiel Meir Katz, known as the Gibor Rav, compared the threat of the Internet to the dangers that Zionism and the European Enlightenment posed in the past to traditional Jewish life. A terrible test has been sent to us that has inflicted so much damage on Haredim, Katz said. The Internet poses a greater threat to Haredim than secularism ever did, he said, because in previous challenges we knew who the enemy was. Today, however, the challenge is disguised and not discernible to the naked eye. Unless that naked eye has like an iPhone or a BlackBerry. We'll see if they can turn back this particular clock of history. It's not so easy to put the genie back into the bottle, is it? And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Phyllis Goldstein. She's the author of A Convenient Hatred, The History of Anti-Semitism, a pretty comprehensive and very readable account of anti-Semitism all around the world throughout history, produced by an organization called Facing History and Ourselves. Phyllis, tell me, what was, in putting together this this work, which is, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it's too academic or too difficult to read. It reads, unfortunately, very easily and smoothly. Which is a credit to you. It's a hard subject. What was the most surprising aspect that you discovered?
I think for me personally, one of the most surprising was how deeply rooted this was in Western culture, this particular hatred. And to the point where it's not always visible to people. until it surfaces in an act of violence or something that seems shocking either now or at the time. But it is deeply embedded in the culture. And that surprised me. I knew it intellectually. But it's only when you get into the stories that you realize how deep it is.
You know, I studied with Michael Meyer, who's a contemporary Jewish historian at Hebrew Union College. We studied anti-Semitism, and his thought was that so much of anti-Semitism is rooted in some of the early patristic writings, the early Christian fathers who helped shape the church, not in Jesus' time, but 200 or 300 years after. Do you think that's so?
I know that's so. There is not much division among scholars about that. It is rooted there, and it's a good example of what happens with words, I think. Much of their writing was not really directed against Jews. It was directed against some Christians who were slipping back into Judaism. And in order to keep them within the church, the kind of rhetoric of the times, which was very exaggerated, much like our own time, where words are overheated, and people understood it in that context. And what we found and what we could trace was that in a different time, in a different context, those words took on a power that I'm not sure the speakers fully intended them to take.
And they seem to revive, even 1,500, 1,700 years later. There are instances, well, I'll ask it as a question. Is it possible to have anti-Semitism without Jews?
There are countries where there is. Some of the surveys that have been done in recent years shows a tremendous amount of anti-Semitic feeling in Spain, where Jews have not lived for 500 years.
One of the interesting aspects of contemporary anti-Semitism in general has been the rise of sort of anti-Semitism in the Islamic world, where Jews usually lived more safely and better than they did in the Christian world until really quite contemporary times.
Right.
Trace a little bit of that history of Islamic anti-Semitism.
A lot of it can be traced to the arrival of Europeans in the Middle East in a serious way. In other words, as conquerors of territory, as imperial powers. And when people travel from one place to another, what they bring with them is their culture. And part of that culture was anti-Semitism. So that's one way it has seeped into the Middle East. Another has been with the growth of nationalism and the rise of Jewish nationalism, but also Arab nationalism. So two nationalisms that are very strong and very passionate colliding, anti-Semitism becomes a weapon in that war.
It has been said that the Nazis' greatest success was inculcating, of course, sort of Hitler's belief system about Jews into the Middle East in a way that seems to be ineradicable. Is that true, or was it there first?
It was there already. It really did come with the arrival of European imperialism in the 19th century and earlier in some places. The French, the British, and other groups controlled much of North Africa and parts of Europe as the Ottoman Empire began to crumble.
The Dreyfus Trial, maybe the most important trial in Jewish history since, trial of Jesus or something, had a tremendous impact on Jewish history and also on European Jewish history, maybe on European history as well. Talk a little bit about the impact of that trial.
It was enormous. In France, it totally divided a country between people who believed in Dreyfus for one reason or another and people who were convinced that he was guilty. News of the trial, and that's one of the interesting things about the 19th century, these stories spread. Today it seems very slowly, but then almost instantaneously. It involved ultimately Germany, England, the United States. People everywhere followed the trials, and they were multiple. And it drew up all of the stereotypes, all of the myths that had been surrounding Jews for hundreds of years. And I think that was the power of the trial. Interestingly, and this was, you asked earlier about what surprised me or what did I learn from this history, I always thought that Judaism was sort of front and center in the trial from the beginning. But in fact, at the first trial, no mention was made of Dreyfus being a Jew. And it doesn't appear in any of the transcripts of the trial. It's only when the mobs gather in the street, when he's degraded, in other words, his uniform is ripped, and his sword and his weapons are taken from him, the crowd is yelling that he's a Jew.
It was the mobs.
It's one of those things where that history, that rootedness of those stereotypes just come to life one more time.
You have a really interesting quote from the British author Howard Jacobson in your book. The language of extremism has a malarious dynamic of its own, passing effortlessly from the mischievous to the unwary and from there into the bloodstream of society. And he uses it to address the infection of anti-Semitism. How does one combat that?
It's a very good question. I think the mistake that we've often made is that we can just stop it in its tracks. In other words, if people know the truth, if we speak out, and we speak firmly about this is not true, this is wrong, we can eradicate it. But I think it's like everything else. You have to teach it in every generation. You have to work for it. Are things better now than they were in Dreyfus's day? You betcha. But they're still not where any of us would like them to be. And I think it's a constant battle. It's the same thing we're seeing with racism. We think it's under control, the laws are in place, but something happens and it erupts one more time. So I think it's through education, it's through law, it's through a society that's committed, but that commitment has to be constantly renewed.
Well, it does, and the book, A Convenient Hatred, The History of Anti-Semitism, is a great start on teaching people about this awful history, but an important part of knowing how it is that we can function in the world without it. I want to thank Phyllis Goldstein for a great visit. You can find this book on the web. The website for Facing History is facinghistory.org, correct?
Facinghistory.org, correct. And it's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Phyllis, thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciated this opportunity.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our very interesting and controversial guest will be Rabbi David Ben-Dori, the self-proclaimed gun rabbi. I'm not making that up. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TwoJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning for the agricultural aspect of the Festival of Shavuot today comes from the great African-American singer Nina Simone, singing the Israeli classic song Eretz Avat Chalav Udvash. Nina Simone actually was taught this song by Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach of blessed memory, who performed the Hasidic folk songs of his in some of the same clubs that Simone was featured in singing jazz. Pretty cool rendition. My friends, have a Chag Shavuot Sameach, a happy holiday of Shavuos, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I love the liver.